Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the 100th edition of the Supertone Show.
The Beatles. All You Need Is Love. And that's released as a non-album single on the 7th of July in 1967 on the Parlophone and Capitol Records labels. And it was also added to the US LP release of the Magical Mystery Tour album.
Which undoubtedly agitated them because they didn't like the singles being released in other albums.
Especially
no,
it's
in
one
the
of
US.
Those protocols. Protocol.
Well, this is our 100th edition.
How do you feel to be a centenary?
Well, I don't know. It's a bit of an odd feeling because it's a lot of work that's gone into this.
Over
these 100 shows, the research and all that stuff. Which I know you do the vast majority.
I know you've
of.
Offered, but the thing is, it works because we kind of have the jousting bit, don't we? And I quite like it. So I like it. I mean, you do your own outsider reading anyway.
I do indeed.
I know you secretly prefer.
I know quite a lot of stuff anyway. So there we are. But let's get back to the 100 show, which is still featuring 1967. A year of incredible music. And this, again, is featured in 1967. And what we haven't actually chosen our favourite tracks from 1967 on this show, because there are so many of them anyway, and we've sort of peppered them through over the past, you know, what, four or five shows throughout. And but the Beatles, of course, are, you know, an absolute foundation of the 60s, and a foundation really in 1967, because in this year they released Sgt. Pepper, did they not?
They did. Yes, they did.
Yes.
Simon.
Yes. And, you know, it was, this song was written by John Lennon, and credited as usual to as Lennon and McCartney, but it was all about this peace thing, because he was writing about, it was a reaction to what was happening in 1967, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And he was very much into, you know, peace and love and all that sort of stuff. Yoko was on the scene.
But it was also because they were invited to take part in the world's first ever multi-country broadcast called Our World. And so he wrote this song specifically for that broadcast.
Yeah.
And it was because he wanted to keep the lyrics simple because of the translation issues.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Okay. So this is where that the you're right, absolutely. And everyone knows this about John Lennon with the Yoko and the way that he was thinking about peace, and the way sometimes he'd sing in and out, and you know, the revolutionist stuff.
Yeah.
And but just so it was just a month after they released Sgt. Pepper, they were invited to represent Britain in the first ever international live satellite television broadcast.
Okay.
So it was crazy. And this is just at the time when you've got America, Canada and Europe, and they've got this youthful optimism of the counterculture right at its peak at the summer of love. So it makes me laugh that. They performed. They actually closed the show. I'm going to just work that out because I was just doing some extra research as the song was playing. And it's estimated that between 400 and 700 million people watched that broadcast.
Well, that is unbelievable.
I'm speechless.
Even by today's standards, that's amazing, isn't it? And, of course, the technical problems that they had, because in Jeff Emmerich's book, which is a fantastic book, sadly he passed away, pretty recently, he was the engineer behind the Beatles, because it wasn't all about Sir George Martin. He did the arrangements. He did a magnificent arrangement of those horns and strings on that. That sounds amazing.
Yes.
You know? What I didn't, just talking about the strings and everything and the horns,
go on.
At the end there, I don't know if you noticed, but I've just heard it right at the very end. Somebody's playing In the Mood by Glenn Miller.
Yeah, yeah.
Da, 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 da. And it's super speed, of course. But it's amazing that this was done live. And Emmerich apparently said it was absolute nightmare, because the BBC engineers were trying to get it all together. And it was the biggest thing that they've ever done, you know. So they were all running around like
headless chickens. But how ironic that it started off with the French national anthem.
Yeah. It sure is. It's unbelievable. But, I mean, the 67, in 1967, the counterculture was gaining a lot of momentum, you know, huge numbers of young people gravitating towards its new mecca, which is San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district.
Yeah.
And there's a strong musical scene developing, headed by psychedelic bands, The Grateful Dead, Aeroplane, and the word spread of the new phenomena, the hippie. And really, when you look at Jimi Hendrix from that year, he was dressing in very psychedelic clothes, as were Cream, and this, of course, you know, the cover of Pepper was, you know, Sgt. Pepper was an extravaganza of psychedelia, wasn't it?
Well, the thing is, right, the other night when we watched this documentary on Netflix called How the Beatles Changed the World, a couple of nights ago. And we've watched everything, really. Well, a lot of documentaries, haven't we? We've got the collection.
We have.
And we were going, I'm not sure if I agree with that. And suddenly this whole other aspect of the Beatles opened up with regards to the counterculture and the underground scene is underground for a reason. It's like not a lot of people know it. And they were saying it really, that what happened was that Paul McCartney was dating Jane Asher, and he was living in London up in the top flat of his her parents' home. She was a TV presenter, and I always remember from baking cakes because that was years later. The other guys of the Beatles had moved out to Surrey, but he, but Paul McCartney was going out every night, and he became curious, and he was still hungry for knowledge and experience, and there was this big beat poet. Celebration in the Albert Hall, and the beat poet Allen Ginsberg was there, and those people like Timothy Leary, they were all, he was just so still curious, and I think there was this bookshop called Indica that opened, and he brought John Lennon in when it first opened, because it was all connected in, I think there was a connection with Jane, and it's just what we didn't understand was that actually it was Paul McCartney who gave, in a way, the inspiration for this other side of the Rubik's Cube for the Beatles. And they almost, some people say now from this documentary, which is, I've been thinking about this a lot, that if it hadn't been for the Beatles sort of mainstreaming the counterculture, the underground, the hippie culture, the minority, they infused that into their music. Because when Strawberry Fields was released, they all thought the Beatles had gone weird.
Yeah.
Because it had this like Salvador Dali-esque kind of video to accompany it. And they didn't know what was going on. And then they decided that they wanted to do this album with Sgt. Pepper, where they didn't want to be the four mop tops or the Fab Four. They wanted to create a new identity for themselves. And that's the prism of understanding of the counterculture, which they really unleashed to the world. So it's almost like it wouldn't have been so widespread or even known, because a lot of people didn't know about the counterculture before the Beatles really got involved, because why would it?
Yeah. Well, and one thing about Sgt. Pepper, though, is that I don't like the album. It is an album. I must say I don't like it. I mean, obviously, there are songs on it. The production's fantastic, the innovation and all that, but I do think they've done better albums. You know, Revolver, I think, is a better album. Rubber Soul, I love Rubber Soul. Magical Mystery Tour, the US version that we have on 100 HM vinyl, reissue, I think it's a better album. There's more stuff on there, you know, that is cool. And I think a lot of the singles also were cool, like Strawberry Fields, which never appeared on a UK album anyway. No. So, you know, everybody talks about Pepper, and I think it was more about a statement. I mean, I know that Sir George Martin, the late great Sir George Martin, said it was like their triumph, their massive triumph. And I agree from a technical point of view and, you know, actually breaking into new ground with the band. But I do believe the energy of like Revolver is better.
I'll soon be with you, my love. Give you my dull surprise. So long to it's the morning and just we two.
Cream, Sunshine of Your Love, from their second studio album, Disraeli Gears, released on the 2nd of November 1967 on Reaction Records, a British label set up by their manager, Robert Stigwood. Now, Robert Stigwood was not liked by the band. We're reading a book on Cream at the moment. I've sort of nearly finished it and you're sort of...
Well, you keep nicking it so yeah. that, you know, it's like...
We sort of share it, but it's an incredible, very well researched book. Actually, it's a really great book. But Cream, of course, released this on an album in November 67, of course, and again as a single in December 67.
Yeah.
So it was produced by Felix Pappalardi. I always get that name wrong. And engineer Tom Dowd.
Tom.
And, yeah. Recorded at Atlantic Studios in New York. And the recording sessions only took 3.5 days. A feat considering the length of the album. Amazing. And I have read Tom Dowd's book. We've looked at his documentary.
Yeah.
We've done all sorts of things looking at Tom Dowd. He's an incredible producer.
What an inspirational guy.
He was. And he was used to recording like Aretha Franklin,
yeah,
and Ray Charles, and all of a sudden these British boys rocked up with a load of 100-watt Marshall heads, and I can tell you now, right? I know how loud a 100-watt head is at a Marshall because I've owned a lot in my time. Even now, we've got new Matamps, which are a Matamp is a British amp from it was designed originally in the early 60s. By Matt Mathias. We've got one in the house now. It's 120 watts. And I used it at a gig the other night and I couldn't have it off one. I'm not kidding. It was blisteringly loud. It was like taking people.
It was like a dragon, wasn't it? It was kick ass.
It's like somebody's. It's taking somebody's. Oh, yeah. It's an incredible sounding thing. But it's fiendishly loud. So, and I know to get that sound that Clapton was getting there, he didn't use a fuzz pedal. It was straight into the amp with his SG at the time, I think, and Gibson SG. And to get that sound with that distortion, it was unbelievably loud. And Tom Dowd didn't know how to record it because it was so fierce. And the drum pattern on there, Tom Dowd came up with as well because we were really struggling with this song. And I think we've mentioned this in the show before, but he came up with that sort of... Native American beat. Mm.
When you play it right, it really puts you off in a way because, you know, when I play the bass line to that song,
yeah.
it's like, how do you put it? It's like you've got a prism across your eyes and left hand and right hand are going across you and you belong to both.
Yeah,
it feels really tribal.
Because the whole groove is not based on the one and bass players. No. That you know the one is the thing. The one and the first beat.
It's
of the
amazing.
Yeah,
it's an incredible experience actually when you actually play with the drummer who gets that groove right.
Absolutely amazing. Now and Arut Arugan, who was the one of the directors of and owners of Atlantic Records, who signed them.
Yeah,
he was very unhappy because he was expecting a blues album that was like found
like
on the
you
first
do.
Album, Fresh Cream.
Like you do.
And Jerry Wexler, a famous Jerry Wexler, who's a partner as well.
It's a hit.
Yeah,
kind of guy.
Put it out.
Yeah, put it out.
He called it psychedelic hogwash. This is the album, which is
not
amazing.
Hogwarts, hogwash.
That's right. But Booker T, producer and keyboard players Booker T and the MGs, of course, and Otis Redding, both who were Stax recording artists, they actually gave Sunshine of Your Love the thumbs up and give wholehearted approval to it, which made everything smooth over.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, that is a classic rock and roll record of 1967.
Yeah.
Completely diametrically opposite to the Beatles, yeah. that were doing more, you know, it was a lot
that
softer.
British fusion, wasn't it, of blues and rock?
Yeah.
Really?
But
and they say the direct precursor to Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, I mean, but you can hear it, because you can hear Led Zeppelin and it, in it, really. You can hear that sound. I mean, Jimmy Page was a session musician. He'd been playing at the Yardbirds at this time, of course.
Yeah.
And so they were all listening to each other, and they were hanging out, because, I mean, you know, Jimmy Page and Clapton were very close geographically in London, you know, and Jeff Beck.
You know, we've watched... film footage from the Albert Hall, and we've watched Cream recently, haven't we?
Yeah.
And they're just like chaotic. There's this energy. I mean, Jack Bruce is annoying to himself. Ginger Baker is as well. I mean, there's like these three spiraling donkeys from like the Arabian Nights. Have you ever watched Banana Splits? I'm giving my beautiful childhood programmes away. But there's this energy between the three of them, and then they link together, and before you know it, they've just gone off somewhere completely different.
Yeah, and you know, the thing with Ginger Baker, though, quite honestly, I never liked him. I've never liked him as a drummer. I don't think he's very groovy. I don't particularly like listening to him. You know, but the songs work with him in it, like White
Room.
It couldn't be any other band. It couldn't be any other drummer. Yeah. But it always sounds like he's falling downstairs with his drum kit to me. It's always, and it's like there's no real groove and backbeat, you know. And like Ringo. I mean, Ringo. Everybody talks about Ringo Starr. And, you know, he's not a great drummer, but he's an amazing drummer, because you listen to how much he's featured on those Beatles records. It's unbelievable. You know, it's Tom Phils. The way he played, he was very much a part of the band. And I know that Paul McCartney played drums on quite a few of the tracks, in actual fact, but later on. But, you know, Ringo was a great drummer. He really created something special, you know?
Yeah.
And after this, I mean, Clapton went, you know, because the band all fell to pieces, and Clapton went on and did Eric Clapton, you know?
Yeah.
a song, play guitar, make it snappy. Out in tears. Please don't be sad if it was the straight line you had. We wouldn't have known you all these years.
Traffic. Dear Mr. Fantasy, the title track from the debut album released on the 8th of December 1967 on Island and United Artists. It reached number 16 in the UK charts.
Now,
yes,
the lead singer, Steve Winwood.
Love Steve
Winwood. Well, he's a genius.
Remarkable.
And I think that out of all the musicians in 1967, this is a big statement, this is, don't I? I think that he is the most distinctive. I really do think so, because his voice is so distinctive and he's so ridiculously talented. I mean, Hendrix, of course, was a master guitar player, Clapton, all these people. But Winwood, he sings amazingly. He plays Hammond organ amazingly. He does guitar. He plays guitar amazing. He's an amazing musician. And he's just got everything. And in a few shows ago, we had the Spencer Davis Group on, of course,
yes,
which were also released a single in 1967, and he was lead singer in that. And then he comes up with a new band, Dear Mr. Fantasy, with Traffic. And it was amazing, you know, and what they were doing. And this was produced by Jimmy Miller.
Jimmy Miller.
Now, Jimmy Miller sadly passed away, but a legendary producer. We did it, and we've said this in the past, we did a show on him right early on in these 100 podcasts that we've
it's
done.
Great, isn't it, to say that? 100!
And at the end there, he got his maracas out as the...
Yeah, not like a Lewis Litt and suits or anything that from that programme. The literal musical maracas.
He got his maracas. Because he loved getting involved in performance. And at the end there, it's all speeding up. He wanted to go and make it more energetic.
Yeah.
So he whipped out the control room with a pair of maracas. And you can actually hear them maracaing around there. Amazing.
Ran down the studio, yeah.
But the engineer on this session is Phil Brown, one of our great friends.
That's crazy beautiful, by the way.
And hopefully we're going to be working with him soon. He's a great engineer.
Great chap.
Yeah, a lovely bloke. We met him in London. I did it with him. He's cool. And he's worked with everybody. He recorded the solo for Led Zeppelin and Stairway to Heaven. He's done absolutely loads of stuff. But he was like a staff person for Ireland at the time.
Yeah.
And he said, when asked for his favourite memory of engineering, he responded, recording Dear Mr. Fantasy at 1 o'clock in the morning in November 1967.
At the mecca of all studios,
Olympic. Yeah. And, you know, it's... Everything there sounds great there. It really does. But, you know, it's a very British sound and completely different what was going on in America. It's sort of rougher. It's more distorted. And I mean, we talk about Olympic and, you know, Led Zeppelin was done at Olympic and it's an amazing studio. But it had a sound. It had that. It's quite aggressive. It's quite, you know. And I think the way that we mix stuff was quite aggressive, wasn't it? You know,
yeah.
The Brits.
I think with it was the staff as well. It was the training. It's like it that there you've got like Glyn Johns and you've got all these different people with those skills and they're passing on and Chicanx, is it George? Remember, yeah. We've still who is George? Yeah. Where is George? You know, yeah. And it's just when you know start to know about it's the people. It's not just the building. It's the people in the building, surely. But it's also the way it inspires you, as you say, and also the approach to recording.
Well, that's right. And I mean, Traffic were never a traditional rock band. I mean, Jim Capaldi was a singer, songwriter, and drummer. And I did meet him years ago.
What?
Revolution Studios with Andy Mack. And we talked about Andy Mack last week and John Astley, who mixed or remixed Who Live at Leeds and many of the Who albums and stuff. And, you know, Chris Wood's reed instruments gave the band a unique flexibility. Dave Mason, the guitar player, I think we parted company with right after this album, didn't
they?
Right after the release.
Yeah.
You know, the guitar player, and the fuzz guitar on that is really good. I've heard that it was Steve Winwood who played the lead solo on that, actually. But,
really?
Yeah.
You never know. But, I mean, when they released it in the US as well, and they actually, in America, though, as you look into it, it was actually customary to include single releases on the albums, whereas in the UK it wasn't.
Okay.
So that was kind of a record industry standard thing. Mm. So it wasn't just to the Beatles, because you kind of thought, oh, no, the Beatles, they did it, and that was just them. No, it was an industry practice.
Mm.
But because Mason had left the band, I think they say that, you know, they wanted to kind of minimise his involvement, so they changed some of these songs as well. They included some singles and they renamed the album as well. So, and I think they... the second pressing was retitled Heaven Is In Your Mind.
Blimey.
Suzanne takes you down to her place near the river. You can hear the boats go by, you can spend the night beside her, and you know that she's half crazy, but that's why you wanna be there. And she feeds you tea and oranges that come all the way from China, and just when you mean to tell her that you have no love to give her, then she gets you her wavelength, and she lets the river answer that you've always been her lover. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know that she will trust you, for you've touched her perfect body with your mind. Jesus was a sailor when he walked upon the water, and he spent a long time watching from his lonely wooden tower. And when he knew for certain only drowning men could see him, he said, all men will be sailors then until the sea shall free them. But he himself was broken long before the sky would open. Forsaken, almost human, he sank beneath your wisdom like a stone. And you want to travel with him, and you want to travel blind, and trust him, for he's touched your perfect body with his mind. Now Suzanne takes your hand and she leads you to the river. She is wearing rags and feathers from Salvation Army counters, and the sun pours down like honey Our Lady of the Harbor, and she shows you where to look among the garbage and the flowers. There are heroes in the seaweed, there are children in the morning, They are leaning out for love. They will lean that way forever while Suzanne holds the mirror. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know you can trust her, for she's touched your perfect body with her mind.
The unbelievable Leonard Cohen, Suzanne, from his debut album Songs of Leonard Cohen, released on the 27th of December 1967, so just in the year, on Columbia Records. First published as a poem called Suzanne Takes You Down in Cohen's 1966 book of poetry Parasites of Heaven in 1966, and also released it as a single.
Yes.
You touch her perfect body with your mind.
I can't believe that that was the one lyric that jumped out of my head.
What a lyricist. And we were in Hanover last week with our new friend, the lovely Olaf Hoffmeister, drummer. Who was
his beautiful partner.
We've been working with recently and some shows. And we went into the record store there and we got a vinyl of Leonard Cohen. Yeah. I mean, we still buy vinyl a lot, you know, we go mad. And it was at secondhand and it was
cool store. I love the secondhand vinyl, you know.
What's it called? 25 Records? I think it was.
25
Records in Hanover.
And they lent us some bikes, so we ended up cycling through Hanover. And Hanover's got this major kind of forest in the middle of it.
Yeah.
It's bigger than Central Park, triple the size. It's huge.
It's amazing.
And we stopped off for a beer halfway through, didn't we? We had a great
Fantastic.
Time. But it's vinyl. Now, Leonard Cohen. I don't know Leonard Cohen. I mean, I do, but you know, I don't know him. I don't know his heartbeat. I know of him. I know about the Chelsea Hotel. You know the famous Blue Raincoat. You know of him, but it's like, do you know him? You know, do you feel him?
Well, if you remember, quite a long time ago, we watched a documentary.
And I kind of fell out with him.
Yeah, and you fell out with him because you thought he was a bit... Well, I don't know, you didn't sort of get on with him, but
no,
the more you listen to Leonard Cohen, the more beautiful he becomes, you know, because he wasn't a beautiful man he was handsome. Was he handsome? I don't know. But he definitely had a thing, you know, and his voice was so deep and so low and...
I had this amazing discovery this afternoon, though, and for me, because I always kind of half fell out with him because he wrote this droning song and it was My Name. Because it's really weird. Seriously, though, there are two songs to Suzanne. It's like, Suzanne, Beware of the Devil, and there's Suzanne, to Blaze by the River. Like, oh, for goodness sake, can't someone just write something upbeat? But then I read the story and she's beautiful. It's about a real lady called Suzanne Verdell, and they spent the summer of 65 together. They met and she had this beautiful romance with a guy called Armand, and then they had a baby together, a baby girl, and sadly they split up. So she moved to this kind of rickety old house with crooked floors, but it had a poetic view of the St. Lawrence River.
Okay.
So Leonard found out about that she'd moved, and so he used to go and hang out with her for the summer. They spent a few months just as friends hanging out, and they would walk through the streets and see different things. But at home, she would always light a candle, and she called the flame Anastasia.
Wow.
And she would serve tea, and they would have mandarin oranges. And she said that they would be quiet for several minutes and just be quiet together, and then they started chatting and they talk about life and they share ideas about poetry and other things. She seemed so beautiful. She was actually quite a recycling champion at the time. She was actually going down to the Salvation Army and making new clothes out of old material.
Wow.
And I just really love the idea of her. And now that I kind of know more of the reality and the intimacy of the story, I mean, they were platonic. I think she said in the interview, well, I did read in the interview, and different things. I'm not interested about whether it wasn't a sexual relationship, but she said that he observed her. And it was only years later, because they never really were close again after the song was released.
Okay.
Because it was Judy Collins, actually, who read the poem, persuaded Leonard to actually turn it into a song.
Is that
she
right?
She adored it. Yeah, so this is the thing, you don't know really what's gone on, and it's like, oh, okay. And
He used to take a long time writing his material. This took
4 or 5 months.
4 or 5 months to write lyrics.
I thought that.
But actually, when you read them and listen to them, they have power. They really have power. And you know, you look at Bob Dylan, and he has power with his lyrics. And I think that Leonard Cohen and Neil Young are the three people from that type of thing, when you know, that have that power. In the lyrics as individual song meisters.
Well, I raise you.
Go on.
Scott Walker. 10 years.
Well, Scott's he's on a different planet. He was on a different planet,
no,
you know.
No, seriously.
We had Scott on today because at the moment we're just installing a new Cadac console that we've got here. Well, it's an old one, but vintage, but we're actually putting it in.
We're making cables.
And
I've
been
making
cables
like
for the past week.
Warrior.
Yeah, so that's what I've been. So I've been listening to all the vinyl again as I've been soldering. It's been brilliant. So
I know, it's beautiful. But Richard Thompson said something really interesting about Leonard Cohen. He said he seemed as if he to be writing as an adult, which he said was not always a given in the 60s.
Mm.
And so we've got this thing with Judy Collins as well. So she asked him to turn it into a song. She recorded it and released it herself as well. But Leonard Cohen always saw himself as just a poet, and he was ashamed of his voice and his acoustic guitar skills. You would never know this. And this is what really opened my heart to him, really. So anyway, he was asked to play a fundraiser with her. And she said that he'd never sung in front of a large audience before then. And this was in 1967. So Leonard got out on stage and started singing. And everybody was going crazy. They loved it. And you know what? He stopped halfway through and walked off the stage. he couldn't take it. So, and everyone went nuts, and they demanded that he come back and produce a song. And so did she. She said, look, I'll go back out with you. So they went back out together. They sang the song. And, of course, that was the beginning.
cold-hearted orb that rules the night removes the colors from our sight. Red is gray and yellow white, but we decide which is right and which is an illusion. Pinprick holes in a colorless sky let insipid figures of light pass by. The mighty light of 10,000 suns challenges infinity and is soon gone. Nighttime to some, a brief interlude. To others, the fear of solitude. Brave Helios, wake up your steeds. Bring the warmth the countryside needs.
Nights in white satin, never reaching the end. Letters I've written, never meaning to send. Beauty I'd always missed with these eyes before. Just what the truth is, I can't say anymore, 'cause I love you. Some try to tell me thoughts they cannot defend. Just what you want to be, you will be in the end. And I love you.
breathe deep the gathering gloom. Watch lights fade from every room. Bedsitter people look back and lament. Another day's useless energy spent. Impassioned lovers wrestle as one. Lonely man cries for love and has none. New mother picks up and settles her son. Senior citizens wish they were young. Cold-hearted orb that rules the night removes the colors from our sight. Red is gray and yellow white, but we decide which is right and which is an illusion.
Moody Blues and The Day Begins and The Night from their second album and first concept album, Days of Future Past. And that was released on the 10th of November in the UK and a day later in the US in 1967 on the Derham record label. Now, it went to number 27 in the UK album charts and eventually peaked at number 3 on the US Billboard charts in 1972. So it was a bit of a slow burner, that one. But it created an entire genre and was one of the first examples of progressive rock with its fusion of orchestral and rock elements. And it's one of the most enduring and defining albums of the counterculture era.
Well, the Moody Blues are probably one of the top three bands, our favourite bands together. And, you know, we've listened to an awful lot of them. We love them. We love the Mellotron. We love the lyrics. We love the feel. We love the guitar playing of Justin Hayward, his voice. But they all sang. And it was like an amazing, amazing band, but only when Pinder was in it. When Mike Pinder was in it, that was when it was the real Moody Blues, because he was the Mellotron man and used Chamberlain, and which was another version of the Mellotron. But the interesting thing about this record, it came about by accident, because Decca Records wanted to demonstrate their new stereophonic sound that they
Dramic
called
sound.
Dramic sound. And so it was already a hit with classical listeners, but what they wanted to do is cross over into the rock and roll market. And
yeah.
Tony Clark, who was the producer, convinced them, this is Decca, to actually do a record with the Moody Blues and actually put this orchestral thing on it.
But they expected an orchestral version of Dvorak.
What I love, and because that da-da-da-da-da-da-da, oh, which is the main sort of theme that goes through Nights in White Satin, that Mike Pinder wrote that at rehearsal, and that's what really nailed the song. But I love the way Peter Knight picks that up at the beginning, yeah, that, you know? And the first section of that is like from the beginning of the album. It's a bit of a mishmash, really. But and the last section that we heard, Nights in White Satin, of course, is The Night. And I would urge you to go and buy the record on vinyl. It still sounds fantastic. We play it all the time. It's on the turntable as much as Led Zeppelin. I can only
it's
say
true.
That. Yeah.
It's true. They inspire us so much, and it's just is so emotional as well, and so I think intellectually stimulating in a really weird way, and so much so you can hear so much of the plagiarism from Andrew Lloyd Webber as well.
Yeah.
I keep hearing these theatre tunes coming out all over the place from the stuff he's written, but you know, great, you know, everyone inspires everyone else.
Absolutely marvellous, and apparently it took 5 days to finish.
Yeah.
And after each day, they sent the edited tapes out to Peter Knight, and he'd write the orchestral arrangements to fit the gaps. That's incredible.
But do you know what's really cool about this, right? Is they said they agreed with the Decca guys, right? They do this Dvorak thing. They said, yeah, we'll do it. They went down the pub and decided that they weren't going to do that, right? They were going to do that. They'd been working on a stage show. So yeah, they ended up doing that, and they surprised the execs by just giving them the finished product. And there was a guy called Walt McGuire who happened to be in town, who was basically Decca from the USA, because the Decca executives in the UK didn't like it. They were going, what's this? And he said, give it to me, I'll take it. And that's how it got released, because he believed in it.
But I'm afraid that's the end of our 100th Supertone show.
Get in there.
Yeah, you know, it's been a great journey and looking forward to the next 100.
We've learned so much, haven't we? Thanks. Yeah. I love hanging out with you. I wanted to close the show, actually, with a quote from John Lodge. He said, "I knew that our decision to stick to our principles by writing, recording music we felt driven to create was the right one."